You're listening to Sipping on Some Crime podcast, hosted by Aaron. This podcast covers sensitive and triggering subjects, explicit language, and mature content which may not be suitable for children. As always, all parties are innocent until proven guilty.
Today, I will be covering the case of Sarah Binford. Sarah was just 14 when she vanished in 2000. Despite a massive search across the UK, she has never been found. So many failed her, and 22 years later, we are still asking how and why. The beginning of how I lay this episode out is going to be very intentional and very different, but I'm doing it for a reason, so please hang in there because it will make sense in the end. Sarah was born in Kettering. In her early years, she lived in a red brick terrace on Havelock Street. She lived with her mother, Vicky, stepfather, Gavin, brother, Josh, and sister, Anya. Social services would soon enter little Sarah's life at the tender age of 2. She began skipping as early as reception. And for my listeners not in the UK, reception is before first year of primary school, or elementary as we call it. Reception is after nursery school or preschool, and before year 1, which we call kindergarten, so the ages between 4 and 5. By the age of 8, she was skipping primary school and running away from home. When Sarah was 11, she started at Montague School, and at the time, she was described as a bubbly, confident girl. In just 3 years, she had gone from skipping classes and running away to using heroin, cocaine, speed, and sniffing aerosols. In 1999, her mother, Vicky, agreed for her to go to a home to keep her away from the people she was socializing with. Petty criminals in Kettering that had been hanging out with her more and more, and her mother said they used Sarah to steal things and sell them to help pay for their own drug habits. At this point, there were signs of her self-harming as well. Sarah had been in and out of 3 girls' homes by the age of 14. Sarah's last children's home was Welford House, in which 41 of 150 days of her placement, she was missing. Sarah first ran from home in March 2000 and was found April 2nd. During her intake back into the girls' home is when she would tell staff that at just 14, she had been engaging in sex with men. As we know, and I will always state as a reminder, 14 is not the age of consent. April 3rd, 2000, Sarah would again flee this girl's home without her backpack, diaries, and only taking the clothes that she was wearing. The home would report her missing to the authorities. On the 6th of April, Sarah would visit her mother at work at an amusement arcade in Kettering Town Center, where the two would get into an argument and Sarah would walk away telling her mother she would see her tomorrow. And that would be the last time her mom, Vicky, ever saw her again. August 2000, now 4 months into Sarah's disappearance, investigators would receive a tip that Sarah was seen with a well-known pimp at the Service 6 in Wellingboro, North Amptonshire, purchasing a pregnancy test. It would be the manager at the Service 6 that spotted her and called in the tip. As the months follow into Sarah's disappearance, 2 more people, a man 29, a woman 37 from Kettering, would be arrested on suspicion of supplying drugs to Sarah. A murder inquiry would be launched September 2003 after investigators finally admitted at this point in the investigation there was little to no evidence supporting that Sarah had survived beyond the first few months of her disappearance. As the investigation moved forward, lots of tips and leads were followed up on and more searches were conducted as well as lots of arrests but no charges. A man from Kettering that was 54 at the time and a woman 38 years old and a 48-year-old man from London were all arrested on suspicion of murder, but were all released with no charges. A bit later, a woman, 41 years old, from Kettering, would be arrested and charged with suspicion of murder. But again, she would be released and no charges would be filed against her. A 46-year-old woman out of London was arrested on suspicion of perverting justice. As to if her charges stuck, I see no follow-up report. In 2003, a case review looking into the handling of Sarah's case by the Northamptonshire Police was conducted by the Derbyshire Police to look into a possible shortfall of the initial investigation. That review was completed, but the results were not shared with the public. The investigation into Sarah's whereabouts was codenamed Operation Yacht. By 2004, this investigation had gone cold, and the resources into her investigation were scaled back. So at this point, we arrive here with facts, the very dry facts. I wanted to point out that I did this intentionally in this episode because, as we all know, that's not my style. I try my hardest to put out as much information on the victim as possible. I always want to know who they were, what their family dynamics were, anything personal I can find about the victim that helps people connect. I want to bring those to the surface before we jump into the what. Every victim is so much more than the awful event that happened to them. I wanted to format this episode the way that the media reported about Sarah, the way the police saw her case, how the public handled it. See, at this point, nobody had stopped to investigate why Sarah was in and out of these homes, why she was skipping school so young, why she was choosing to run from each home she had been placed in, how she was doing such heavy drugs by the age of 13. From what I found, it seems like Sarah was very close to her Uncle Andy, and when he suddenly died in September 1999 is when they noticed she was really struggling with his loss. And that's when she would turn to drugs and hanging around older people on the streets. As to her prior years, what was causing her to skip school and run away? I don't have that answer. From 1999 to 2000, she would spend time in Raven Children's Home in Corrie. Then she would be sent to an isolated secured unit called St. John's in Tiffield, run by Northamptonshire County Council, which a former resident called the place that was meant for anyone with nowhere else to go. She would then be moved to Welford House. When she arrived at Welford House, she was 13 and admitted at the time to having sex with boys in Abingdon Park. And that's when she also began injecting herself with heroin. The staff had her examined by a doctor after she had taken heroin, and the doctor noted there was nothing wrong with her. When she returned to the home, the staff, instead of getting her help and finding someone to talk about these sexual experiences with, they just told her to make sure she was using contraception. Sarah would later come to her mom, Vicky, telling her she really wanted to leave that home. She told her it was like a holiday camp that let her come and go as she pleased. Look, you know I don't speculate, and I don't try to assume anything, but a child coming to a parent saying, "This place lets me come and go, and I need out," sounds like a desperate plea for help and some structure and security. When she's 14 and informing the staff she's now having sex with grown men, not boys, there's no report to police about these sexual assaults on a minor. Why didn't they report it? Why didn't they get her help? Why was no one listening to this child who was obviously being groomed and used by adults on the streets? So let's look back at 2000, when Sarah goes missing. When she's reported missing from the children's home in April, we know she goes to see her mother on the 6th, and that ends in an argument, but with Sarah saying she will see her mother tomorrow. What the news failed to report at the time was that later that day, Sarah calls her mother from a house in Hampton Crescent, Kettering. Her mom knew she was high on drugs, and she knew where the house was. Vicky immediately calls the police to report where her missing daughter is. They already have a missing report on her, and she begs them to go to the house and pick her up. They refuse. She begs again. They refuse. Documents given to the newspapers later show that police officers informed the care home where Sarah was on the 6th, but told them they could not go and collect her, and they would not take her to the Kettering police station and babysit her. That single decision, that moment, led us here. 22 years later, and Sarah is gone, never to be seen again. We know that the trail goes cold pretty quickly due to the lack of investigation in the beginning and the media coverage portraying Sarah as a troubled girl who turned to prostitution and drugs. There were rumors that Sarah may have traveled to Finchley, London, rather that she had been trafficked to that area by a pimp or a trafficking ring. But there has never been any evidence proving that, and there's never been any evidence to show that she was actually ever there. Vicky, desperate to find her daughter, took matters into her own hands, walking the streets and parks of Kettering for months looking for Sarah. May 12, 2000. June Black, Sarah's grandmother, frustrated with the lack of coverage on her granddaughter's case and the lack of attempts made by investigators to find her, phones reporters at the Evening Telegraph and tells them she is begging for Sarah's safe return. A reward for £5,000 would be offered after that, and June would diligently stay involved in the search for her granddaughter, putting pressure on police and media until her death in 2003. She did get to see police officially launch a murder investigation for her granddaughter before her passing. Before the murder investigation was launched in 2003, investigators would focus on a person of interest, Richard Jenkins. Sarah had been friends with Richard's daughter, Jessica, and had been to their house several times before her disappearance, and even stayed there a few nights. 18 months after Sarah's disappearance, Richard and his daughter would move from their home in Kettering on Highfield Road to Mustique Oak Wood Estates in South Wales. Since the last reported sighting of Sarah the day she went missing was on Highfield Road, that brought investigators to Richard's residence. Even though he had already moved, that didn't stop investigators from searching the home on Highfield Road, looking for anything that could possibly put Sarah there. And when they found nothing there, they moved to his new house in South Wales, where they dug up his garden, searching for clues in Sarah's disappearance. As far as we know, they found nothing at either residence that they could link her disappearance to them or either one of those homes. In July 2003, Richard, who was frustrated with the investigation, called the Evening Telegraph to speak with reporters, explaining to them that he had nothing to do with Sarah's disappearance, that he didn't even think she was dead and had no idea where she was. A reporter traveled to Wales to interview him. In the interview, Richard said, quote, "Neither myself nor any of my daughters have seen Sarah since she went missing, and I cannot understand why they are looking at my house here in Kettering. All this has really upset my youngest daughter, especially as she thinks I've been accused of killing somebody, as does everyone who saw my garden dug up. What am I supposed to have done? Killed Sarah? Buried her? Then dug her up again 2 years later and moved her to South Wales?" Unquote. That July, Richard was arrested and brought in for interrogation by investigators, but was eventually eliminated and released. Richard says the investigation and media coverage ruined his life. After searching Richard's home and arresting a man and a woman on suspicion of supplying drugs to Sarah, police finally officially launched a murder investigation for Sarah. They had shown through all the searches and interviews that the probability of Sarah being alive was very small. Her family dreaded that news, but still cling to hope that she's still alive. Searches in 2003 moved to Weekley Woods near Kettering as well as Wakerley Woods, on the border of Ruthland and East Northamptonshire. Investigators would then move on to high-profile search, a part of a wasteland owned by an elderly Polish man in remote Findon, near the Furnace Land Industrial Estate. The elderly man was not a suspect of the investigation, just his property. The site was said to be a significant part of Sarah's life. Investigators were joined by archaeologists, forensic officers, and cadaver dogs from Scotland and Greater Manchester. They would take away 9 rundown caravans, 6 wrecked cars, and bags upon bags of random things to a secret warehouse in Northampton to be thoroughly gone through in hopes to find clues about Sarah's disappearance. 6 years later, Detective Chief Inspector Moffat would say the biggest regret of his career was not finding Sarah. 2004, a serious case review of Northampton County Children's Department had concluded that July, and their findings are heartbreaking and glaringly obvious. It was determined that NCC was significantly understaffed. The independent inquiry report stated that social workers were operating with insufficient resources, huge workloads, and lack of procedures. It also found that the label of troubled adolescent masked and minimized the risk factors faced by vulnerable children. They concluded that no in-depth assessment of Sarah's needs was carried out before she went missing, despite problems with non-attendance from school at the age of 5, sexualized behavior from an early age, and suicide attempts. In Sarah's case in particular, it determined that NCC had missed several chances to identify Sarah as a child of risk and didn't follow proper processes to make sure she didn't come to harm. The report detailed that professionals were operating against, quote, black cloth of insufficient resources, overloaded systems, huge workloads, and a lack of comprehensive procedures, unquote. Sarah's disappearance had shone a light on a system that was failing children and had horribly failed Sarah when she needed them the most. NCC would overhaul the way it treated children in their care after that review. They made sure that there was someone always available 24/7 to pick up runaways. They trained staff on signs to look out to point to children being abused. More social workers were hired, and police and care workers vowed to strengthen their links and work as a team to look out for troubled teens. Northamptonshire Police would overhaul the way they dealt with missing children as well. Now, when children go missing, regardless of their backgrounds, there's an instant public appeals to look for them, as well as specialist teams trained and set up to help teens on the street from turning to drugs. The police department and Child Protective Service admitting to dropping the ball and making a real effort to make sure another child doesn't face what Sarah faced is an important step to moving forward. However, we also need to hold the media accountable. Whether the media report it based on the police department's attitude or the child service attitude pertaining to Sarah, or towards these children listed as troubled runaways, or whether it was their own prejudice or societal prejudice that made them report Sarah in a very limited and skewed way, no matter what made them choose to report her as a runaway prostitute instead of a missing child, they are just as responsible for the lack of investigation and care into Sarah's case. When the media pushes that a child, and let's be clear, a child is any person under the age of 18, when a child is pushed in the media as a runaway prostitute, it makes it easier for those in the community to separate themselves and their own children from that child and the possibility of it ever affecting their lives, which we know is not true. It's very apparent that Sarah was being groomed. The unfortunate fact is we don't know when the grooming started or by who, but we know early on in her childhood, Sarah was being targeted, groomed, abused by adults. We know that she was begging for help, whether it was running again and again or directly talking to her mother and saying, hey, this place that I'm at doesn't care if I'm here. Please get me out of here. Get me some help. This was in the year 2000 and the years following into her investigation. But we see in time and time again that labels that the press put on these cases in the public eye matters. As to public involvement and the push of holding police departments and child services accountable for kids and what's happening to them. We see it continue into 2021 and 2022. It's not truly changing. There are cases that are not getting the deserved attention because of the media classification. Now, whether that classification comes from the police department or not, again, the media outlet, you have the responsibility for looking at the report that says prostitute and seeing that it is the age of a child and saying, we're not going to run the headline that says prostitute. We're going to run the correct headline that says sexually trafficked child. Sarah's uncle, Steve Cross, would come forward in 2008 and speak to the Independent newspaper, stating that police didn't treat Sarah's case seriously enough from the beginning. Steve said, quote, Sarah was just another statistic to social services and the police to start with, and they didn't care then with pressure from family. Through the media, they thought, we better do something about this because this isn't going away. There's a culture of secrecy when kids from care homes go missing, unquote. Telegraph reporter Katie Cornyn points to the lack of coverage and the irresponsibility of the media coverage that was surrounding Sarah by talking about a case in 2002, just a few years after Sarah's disappearance. It was a young girl named Millie Dowler, who disappeared from Sussex. She says that the publicity surrounding Sarah's disappearance was in stark contrast to the acres of coverage given to Millie Dowler. I encourage listeners to look up Millie's case because while Millie's case did receive a lot of media attention because she was a beautiful girl missing from your traditional next-door family, there's still a lot of things investigators assumed and did wrong from the jump in her case as well. Right away, the basics of stating that she had run away, not thinking it was possible for her to be abducted in broad daylight, that she must have chosen to leave on her own despite her parents' continued insistence that that just wasn't Millie, and they didn't see a reason why she would just leave on her own. It's an incredibly heartbreaking case. They do find the man responsible for her abduction and death, but the way her investigation plays out and the additional unnecessary pain and agony that investigators put her loved ones through is again another screamingly, glaringly obvious failure that we have in our police departments, not just here in America. I always thought it was just here. The more I look into cases outside of my own country, I'm realizing this is a larger societal view than I ever thought was possible. The problem is that these children and these victims are the ones that pay the price for us not changing our views. So let's bring it back directly to Sarah's investigation. In 2006, an anonymous citizen would hand over documents to a news reporter that detailed the thoughts and feelings of some of the workers that were involved in Sarah's care in her final months at Welford House. One entry from a worker reads about how Sarah was told that her estranged biological father wanted to speak with her, but when the care worker called him on her behalf, her father replied he didn't want anything to do with her. Another care worker talked about how they found Sarah crying in another resident's room with her wrist slashed, yet the next day, Sarah was allowed to go on an unsupervised walk in Kingsthorpe, and when she returned, she was armed with a penknife. When Sarah's mother, Vicky, read these entries, it shattered her heart because she knew Sarah didn't want to be there because Sarah told her she didn't want to be there. Vicky looks back at the conversation with Sarah, in which Sarah specifically said it was like day camp and she could come and go and nobody cared. Vicky said, quote, Sarah didn't want to be there. They promised her that if she went a month without absconding that they would transfer her to Rockingham Dean, where she wanted to be. She behaved herself, she kept her side of the bargain, only to be told she would have to stay where she was, unquote. How much more proof do we need to show Child Protective Services or does the police department need to see that Sarah wasn't a troubled child as they labeled her? She was a child that bad things were happening to, that was being abused in front of everybody's eyes and who was pleading for help and they all failed her. So then the question is, where are we now in the search for Sarah 22 years later? In 2016, which would have been Sarah's 30th birthday, investigators went back to Woodland and Workton area to see if they could find any new clues as to what happened to Sarah. Detective Chief Inspector Martin Kinchin from the Force's cold case team said that they have never given up on discovering what happened to Sarah. Over the years, they do believe they know who killed Sarah. They're confident in their person of interest, but before they can name that name, or pursue that person, they need people from Kettering to come forward and help provide them with evidence. Detective Sergeant Julie Gallagher has been assigned to Sarah's case the past 7 years, and in April 2020, appealed to the public, to those with any knowledge about Sarah's whereabouts, to come forward and help Sarah's family find some peace. At the end of November 2021, investigators working off a tip would spend 2 weeks excavating land in Kettering. Investigators said significant intelligence gathered by their force, Major's investigation team, placed their new search in an area of land in Valley Walk in Kettering. Detective Joe Banfield said, quote, Sadly, we haven't found Sarah yet, but I remain positive that we will find her. It's just going to take some time, unquote. At a press conference a few days later, they did say they hadn't found anything in the initial search area and they were going to expand it to allow a high degree of certainty that they had encompassed and dug in every area they possibly could in an effort to locate an indication of human remains.
Over the last 2 weeks, we've spent a significant amount of time digging different areas of the cordoned off area. That's taken two or three phases. Initially, we responded to the areas of anomaly identified by the Defence Science and Technology Lab using their ground penetrating radar equipment. We took the advice of forensic archaeologists who specialise in this type of body recovery. They identified a number of other areas in there that were around those initial areas of anomaly and were worthy of digging. Then a third phase of this investigation was using the victim recovery dogs to go over the areas that we dug. We extended the parameters around those areas that we dug by venting the ground, leaving it for 24 hours and then allowing those body recovery dogs to go back over. And so a number of phases have been worked through in an effort to locate Sarah, but sadly we haven't managed to locate her at this stage. I'd like to thank everybody involved here and every member of the community that has come down to this site to provide us with information that they thought might be helpful. So there are a number of people that have been identified that we'll be speaking to and following up with, taking statements from potentially, but really speaking to them to find out what they know. So that's the next phase for us, is going forward, is speaking to people that have been identified to us and have identified themselves to us to see what information they've got. And then we will be assessing absolutely everything we have learnt from the dig here, everything we've learnt from members of the community. We'll be comparing that to what we already know, and then we'll be making a decision as about which potential lines of inquiry we follow up from there. We don't know enough about what happened to Sarah, and we don't know where she's buried. What I am very firm on in my opinion of is that somebody out there in this community knows exactly how she died and knows exactly where she's buried. My plea to them is that 20 years have passed. That's 20 years when Sarah hasn't been returned to her family. Hopefully your allegiances have changed. You may be more confident to come forward and give us that bit of information that helps us recover Sarah. That's what I want to do. That's what I want to do for her family. And if you've got that information out there, I'd encourage you to either come forward and speak to the police director 101 or speak to Crime Stoppers if you want to give that information anonymously.
He went on to say, policing in the 20 years since Sarah's disappearance has changed immeasurably. So yes, an investigation, if it happened tomorrow, would be very different. But that's as a result of learning. That's happened over 20 years. It really is generation of policing. Unquote. He did say that the positive of the search, even though they didn't find anything pointing to Sarah, her remains, or her disappearance, was it did trigger people to come forward with information they might not have come forward with before. So they got a number of new tips and pieces of information that they were now able to look at. The biggest thing with these tips came potential new witnesses that were identified that they will now be speaking with in the coming weeks. Unfortunately, coming into 2022, this is where Sarah's case sits. Her loss and the tragic things that this child endured leading up to her disappearance, as well as we can all collectively come to an agreement with the investigators, her untimely death made major changes in those local police departments and child protection agencies. In all that, Sarah deserves to be found. She deserves to be brought home and laid to rest by her family, who has waited 22 years for answers. Those responsible for not only her death, but her abuse need to be held responsible. Sarah deserves justice. I hope this year that we can finally change the page onto that chapter in Sarah's story. I know this was a little different than my normal format of stories. I try extremely hard to keep my emotions out of these cases and give you ABC 123 facts. I know I was able to stick to the facts, even in my emotion in this episode, because I wanted to make sure to put those facts first. I hope that today, after listening, no matter where you live in this world, you're thinking about how to hold people that are meant to protect our children accountable. If you can do anything for Sarah in our everyday lives, it's that. I'll be adding links and resources to those interested in looking deeper into Sarah's case in the show notes and on my website, as always. I will also be adding links and resources into Millie Dowler's case as well, because her case, in the way it was investigated and what her family had to go through, is also an important discussion we should be having. When Sarah disappeared, she was 5'7" with blue-gray eyes and had a self-made tattoo of a cross on top of her arm. The last day she was seen, Sarah was wearing a black puffer jacket, blue patchwork jeans, and cream-colored trainers. She would be 36 now. If you know anything about Sarah's disappearance or murder that would help investigators, you are urged to contact the North Amptonshire Police by phoning 101 or anonymously via the Crime Stoppers hotline at 080-055-5111. Thank you so much for listening to Sarah's story today. Please don't forget, when you see those missing and murdered posts on social media, to click, like, share, and retweet. Every time we share a face, we get closer to solving a case. Until next time.